Hi everyone, welcome to the Beverage Report podcast. I'm your new host, Sarah. I'm a third-year economics student at the LSE. In this episode, we talk to Dr. Flavio Toxford from Cambridge University on vaccines and economic epidemiology. Special thanks to Yunqing and Raza from the podcast team, Dr. Petropolo, Dr. Shapiro, and Annalise O'Donker from the Department of Economics at LSE for their support in the making of this episode. We hope you enjoy it. Flavio, as an LSE alumnus, you completed your MSc EME Econometrics and Mathematical Economics here at LSE. Did your interest in economic epidemiology start back then, or did it come to you at a later stage of your career in academia?
Yeah, thank you. So it actually didn't start until a few years later. I had actually gone after my time at the LSE. I went on to do a PhD. And it was just the first year after I completed my PhD that I started being interested in epidemiology. Having said that, I think that my early interest in dynamics in general was certainly came out of my studies at the LSE, where I spent the bulk of my time learning dynamic optimization tools like dynamic programming, optimal control theory. And once I had kind of become comfortable with those techniques, I started seeing problems that were dynamic in nature, And mathematical epidemiology just lends itself very naturally to that set of tools. So indirectly, you can say that my time at the LSE did kind of help steer me towards this research topic. But no, the idea came later. In fact, my original idea was not to study infectious diseases at all. My idea was to try to better understand how rumors and information spreads in populations. And there was a very nice paper by Banerjee called The Economics of Rumors, where he had a model where information was passed on from one individual to another. And he describes how you could actually use models that are very similar to epidemiology to kind of track this spread of information. And I thought that was fascinating. I was really interested in information diffusion. And so I thought, well, hang on, if he can do it, maybe I can too. And so I bought a book on mathematical epidemiology, thinking there was going to be a gold mine of models that I could take off the shelf and look at infectious diseases as metaphors for information spread. And then what happened is that I realized that there was actually a research field already that had grown out of the policy issues around HIV/AIDS that actually used both techniques from economics and the kind of models that I was now learning about from mathematical epidemiology. And so this happened in about 2003, and then I kind of got stuck. I thought that was a lovely area to explore.
It's definitely in a very interdisciplinary subject. And what makes economic epidemiology so fascinating to you?
So personally, there are a number of things that make it a particularly interesting field. First of all, it's a topic that is extremely important. I think it has always been important, but maybe for most people they have not realized just quite important this field is. And so in terms of just an area where economics actually can make a difference, this is really one of those. Second, I was just very attractive to the beauty of those models. I always found, I always read quite widely in other disciplines, and I always thought that mathematical biology was a particularly nice field. And so these dynamic models seduced me. And I also think it's attractive that it sits between two different disciplines. It sits between the social sciences, because we're talking about policy, we're talking about behavior. But on the other hand, it has clear elements of natural sciences or biology and medicine. And I think that interplay between different disciplines is particularly attractive.
How does the market for vaccines work? What are the similarities shared by the vaccine market and other markets? And if any, what are the fundamental differences?
So the market for vaccines, of course, and broader the market for medicines is unusual in a number of different respects. The most noticeable, perhaps, is that it's a market where there are very few players on each side of the transaction. So in many instances, you know, in undergraduate economics, we always think of you know, the monopolist that is, or a few oligopolists, or a few set of sellers and many buyers. Sometimes in labor economics, we look at a situation where maybe there are many workers, but there's only one firm hiring. But or we look at perfect competition in which there are a lot of people on each side. This is one of those rare instances where there are very few buyers and very few producers on the other side. The buyers typically are national governments or health services or coalitions of governments or countries such as COVAX, which we will probably come back and talk about more. And on the seller side, over time, fewer and fewer people have been engaged in, or rather fewer and fewer pharmaceutical companies have been engaged in vaccine production. And we now have basically four or five major companies sitting on almost the entire market. So this is one distinguishing feature. Another thing that is unusual in the vaccine market is that the buyers don't just take the role of purchasing the final product. That is, the governments don't just, you know, confine themselves to buying the vaccines once they reach the market. In fact, governments are often intimately involved in many stages of the production process, from initial funding to certification and in the end, of course, to buying and to rolling out. So governments are often playing a dual role as both investors in these vaccines and on the other hand, also as buyers of the end product. And this is a somewhat unusual feature that we don't usually see in other markets.
Is there any particular reason why the number of pharmaceutical companies producing vaccines declined?
So yes, first of all, it takes very, very large fixed costs to invent new vaccines. And that has led to a strong concentration in vaccine market. In addition, there's a lot of other, we can call them market failures, really, that have to do with the vaccine market, which also has a lot of interesting economics in it. So, for example, one of the innovations that has been introduced in this space is so-called advanced market commitments that have been developed by Michael Kramer and collaborators. So the idea of the advanced market commitment is basically to create markets for vaccines that otherwise might not exist. So think about vaccines that are primarily targeted for diseases that are of concern to lower and middle income countries, where there might not be you know, very much purchasing power from the government's perspective. And so, because there's not much of a market there, pharmaceutical companies have been reluctant to invest large amounts of money in those markets. Now, from a social perspective, we understand that this is a market failure, and we would like these vaccines to become available. And so one way of doing it, rather than just say, well, please, pharmaceutical company, please produce these vaccines, and we're going to buy them later, the vaccine company, or so rather the pharmaceutical companies, might be reluctant to go ahead on this basis without having a firm commitment that they will actually be remunerated for their investments. And so the advanced market commitment is basically, you can think of it as a price that is released once you hit the market with a vaccine. So typically the shape that these advanced market commitments take is a firm commitment to buy, say, 200 million doses of a vaccine at a pre-specified price. And this is basically a contractual obligation that governments or funding bodies engage in, and that has been used successfully in different contexts. It's also used for the development of antibiotics, which is also a market that has strong market failures. And it is also currently being used by COVAX, which I might now mention what COVAX is. So COVAX is a coalition of funders and governments to ensure cheap and equitable distribution of vaccines to lower income countries. So this is basically a facility that has been set up to ensure that we don't have just the wealthy countries accessing COVID vaccines, but that poorer countries also have access to them. So they have also basically designed an advanced market commitment for vaccines in the current situation.
In your recent publication on the Economics Observatory, Does COVID-19 Change the Value of Vaccines? You walked us through the challenges that economists are facing when quantifying how much vaccines are worth. While the value of vaccines changes with the stage of the pandemic, how can economists measure its value more accurately? And how are these proposals different from the current measurements adopted by the NICE for the NHS? And for our listeners, that is the NICE, National Institute for Health and Care Excellence.
So perhaps let me take one step back and talk a little bit about how you would value any medicine, and then we can talk a bit about how the epidemic changes the situation. So suppose that you're considering whether to buy a specific medicine for a specific patient. So what NICE and the NHS does is try to determine whether this medicine is worthwhile, whether the benefits that the medicine will bring along, whether they are outweighed by the cost of acquiring the medicine and of course administering it and so forth. Now, how would one go about doing such a calculation? Well, it turns out that what NICE and similar bodies does is very similar to the kind of calculation that you would see in an undergraduate economics course. Basically, you calculate something similar to the net present value of the medicine. So you ask yourself, well, this medicine, is it going to make the patient better off? By how much and for how long? So that's the kind of question that is being asked. Now you can ask, well, how do you measure the well-being from a medicine? And there have been many proposals, but the primary approach is one called QALYS, which is quality adjusted life years. And what it does basically, it tries to determine how many life years does the given medicine give the patient additional over and above what he or she would have without the medicine, and also what would be the quality of life during those years. And once you have that, then you can make a calculation that makes it possible to compare the value of the medicine in terms of QALYS with the cost of administering the medicine. So it's basically a very simple cost-benefit type analysis. Now, the difference with vaccines and in fact also with antivirals during an epidemic is that the benefits from a vaccine are not simply those that accrue from avoiding a single individual becoming infected. So as we've seen during the epidemic, a lot of the policies that have been implemented during the epidemic has basically been to ensure that people don't infect others. So when we do, for example, social distancing requirements, when we do mask mandates, when we do lockdowns and so forth, what we're really trying to do is make sure that those who are already infected, that they don't pass on the infection to other people. So when there are infectious diseases, there are typically very strong negative externalities. I infect you, you infect your sister infects her hairdresser, and so on and so forth. And so the value of a single individual becoming immune is more than just the benefit to that individual. It's also the benefit from all those other infected people that are now avoided. And what that means is that the vaccine, when you value a vaccine, you would be strongly understating its value if you just look at an individual and you don't take a more population or public health perspective on the given vaccine. So let me give you a very stark example. Suppose that only one person in the universe can be infected by COVID. And suppose that we could vaccinate that person beforehand. If we just take a very naive approach, we would say, well, it's just one person. How valuable is that? But you quickly realize that if we vaccinate that one person, we would have avoided a global pandemic. So the value is much, much, much higher than just the value of avoiding that one infection. Now, the complication, of course, is that the value of the vaccine changes across the stages of the epidemic. early on, as I just mentioned, the value is fairly high because you can avoid a lot of infection, or not necessarily very early on, but at the earliest stages of an epidemic. At the end of an epidemic, when the infection has already burned out in some sense, the value of the vaccine is very modest. And so that's the sense in which the stages of the pandemic actually changes the value of the vaccine. And that's a complication that economists or health economists will need to grapple with. I don't know that there are very practical and direct efforts to do that right now. But that's what I in some sense called for in that column, to try to rethink how the public funding bodies values these vaccines in context with infectious diseases.
Great. We've looked at the value for the market for vaccines and the value. Let's now talk about individuals. How does the vaccine rollout affect our risk-taking behavior? And perhaps more importantly, what factors, intrinsic or external, will affect an individual's decision to get vaccinated?
So let's take one step back and try to describe the economists' approach to decision making during epidemics, because I think that'll be useful in thinking about how vaccines change those decisions. So the economist's perspective really is just to use a kind of decision theory or game theoretic analysis in context of infectious disease. So what that does is basically it boils down the individual's decision making to a question of trading off costs and benefits of exposing yourself to a disease. So if we think of yourself, you can decide whether you want to go to a nightclub or to the brunch bowl, and there is some intrinsic benefit from going there to meet your friends and so on. But you also know that there's an infectious disease spreading or circulating, and so you might be reluctant to go if you think it's very, very likely you're going to be infected. So that's the kind of situation we see all the time in economics, but in other contexts, of course. So if you think of yourself as trading off costs and benefits of exposing yourself, now on top of that, you add the possibility of vaccinating yourself. Now, what the vaccine does, really in a very simple way, is that it reduces the risks of exposing yourself to the disease. So think of it this way. Suppose that there's some kind of made up disease, let's call it, let's call it disease X, which is you're very, very unlikely to be infected. And if you become infected, it doesn't give you much more than just a cold. Okay. Now, if I told you that such a disease existed, you wouldn't be too worried about it because, you're very unlikely to be infected. And also, if you're infected, it doesn't really do much to you. Now, in that kind of situation, you're not going to change your behavior very much because, who cares? Once you introduce vaccines, that does a little bit the same as this metaphor that I've just painted for you. What it does basically is that reduces your personal risk from exposing yourself in ways that you might find beneficial for you or desirable. In economic terms, you can think of it as an imperfect substitute, or rather a pretty good substitute for social distancing, because in the same way as staying at home and not going to the party, vaccinating yourself also protects you. And so what the vaccine does, it changes people's incentives to engage in very costly self-protective behavior. So that's why many governments are so keen on rolling out vaccines, because what it does is that it allows some kind of resumption of normal economic and social activity, which is extremely costly to scale back, as we've seen during this pandemic. So really what it does is a relatively cheap way of reducing the need to rely on other very costly social distancing measures. Now, having said that, there's a secondary effect, which is more complicated, which is that when you make decisions about what to do in your everyday life, during a pandemic, of course, you're not just thinking about your own susceptibility in purely biological terms. You might also take into account how much infection there is in the population at large. So that means if there's a lot of infection out there, even if you have a vaccine, you might be a little bit more careful about going out because the vaccine is not perfect. Okay. Now, what that means is that when you have a mass rollout of vaccine in the population, that can change the aggregate dynamics of the disease, which in turn may also change your behavior. So let me just give you, for example, let me walk you through an example. You give a lot of vaccines to people, that reduces the number of new infections, but that means that your individual risk, whether you're vaccinated or not, now goes down. And that might induce you to scale up your own social activity. And that, in some sense, counterweighs the original reduction in the vaccine. So you can see how it plays in both directions. So there is some evidence that people react this way. There was a very nice study that looked at infection rates for people who had had one dose of the vaccine. What that study found was that in the week or two after the first vaccine dose, before people realized that it took some time for the effect of the vaccine to kick in, there was an increase in people getting infected. And what that suggests is that people were falsely under the impression that a vaccine was going to protect them a lot, even just after having been vaccinated, and therefore people became imprudent and therefore exposed themselves to more risks and therefore were more likely to be infected. So really, the introduction of vaccines on people's behavior and its interaction with policy is really a hot mess, because there are so many different channels through which it influences behavior and incentives and disease dynamics that is very difficult to get a handle on. So I'm working on this from a theoretical and from an empirical perspective. And I can tell you that this is really something that is very difficult to fully untangle. May I just, you know, add a last complication, which is that behavior also, of course, is determined or shaped by policy, which in itself is also shaped by the course of the epidemic. So, for example, we know empirically that as vaccines were rolled out, people would do less social distancing. Now, why is that? Is it because they are less afraid of the disease because there's now more vaccination? Or is it because the governments have now allowed people to be more free because they have relaxed the policy measures? So untangling those effects is a really important topic, but it's also a very challenging thing to do from a research perspective.
And now we're at the topic of lockdowns, perhaps a distant memory already for those of us living or studying in England. Some people believe that lockdowns simply postpone the pain of COVID, and others appreciate the valuable time it provided for scientists and policymakers to better understand the virus, which leads us to a new concept, the pound of flesh fallacy. Could you tell us a bit more about what this fallacy is about and what's the rationale behind the counterexample you developed back in November 2020?
For those who don't know the reference, the pound of flesh is kind of debt that is unavoidable, that is a terrible thing you need to pay, and that you can't do anything to kind of work around it. That's the pound of flesh. And what got me started to think about that was more and more people and politicians who kept saying that lockdowns are ineffective, because what it does, it just postpones the inevitable disease. Even very prominent epidemiologists have gone out and said things like that, saying, oh, lockdowns are very expensive. They create a lot of economic and social damage. And once you lift the restrictions, people will become infected again. And so that was kind of the thinking. And if this were true, then, of course, the natural conclusion would be, well, let's not do any lockdowns, because it's a little bit like a Band-Aid. If it has to come off, we might as well just do it now. And so it's actually an important question that has strong policy implications. Another metaphor you can think of is what is called the waterbed effect. So think of the waterbed. that is for the, has water in it, of course. And if you sit in one corner of the water, of the waterbed, what it does basically is it pushes the water to the other corners of the waterbed. But the total amount of water is still the same. And so you can use this metaphor to think about infectious diseases as well, that if you suppress it now, you're just pushing it somewhere else and it'll come back later. Now, it turns out to be a fallacy because when you reduce, because of the complicated dynamics of diseases in populations, what most of these models show, and it's not just a theoretical curiosity, this is actually practically true, which is that when you reduce the infection at early stages, it is true that to some extent, you push some infections into the future. But if you look at the number, the overall number of infections at the end of the of time, it actually is reduced. So that means that if we start out from a situation where, say, 100 million is going to be infected, and if you don't do anything, and you now compare that to a situation where you have lockdown measures early on, you might end up at the end with, say, 80 or 90 million instead of the 100 million infections. So it is true that to some extent, when you put a lid on infections early on, you might push some into the future. But it is also true that the overall number of infections is actually lower. And so that's what I term the pound of flesh fallacy, which is basically this idea that is kind of, it leads to a kind of policy fatalism. Whatever we do, the infection is going to do what it's going to do, and therefore we might not need to do anything. In fact, there was a very startling interview recently with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, where he basically says, well, I'm paraphrasing here, the infection is something we can't control. The infection is just going to be what it is. And all we can do is basically to react to what the disease does. And of course, we know full well that influencing the disease through different measures, such as lockdowns, actually makes a difference. And that's why this is such an interesting problem for economists, because if we know that we can influence the course of the epidemic, and we also know that different paths of the epidemic have different value to us in terms of life lost, in terms of public health, and in terms of the economy, then as economists, of course, we think it's completely natural to try to systematically look for policies that are good overall. And this is one of the things that I and many other economists have found so fascinating, which is that we can use many of the standard tools from the economics toolbox to study this kind of optimal policy in the context of the epidemic.
Now, something I believe our audience will be eager to find out, what are your favorite books in economics and any book recommendations for our undergraduate community?
Great. So it's been many years that I haven't read books about economics. I mostly consume either, you know, journal articles or textbooks as such. Maybe I can do something, the next best thing, which is I can talk about the books that have influenced me the most. So an early book that I found completely fascinating was a very, very short book by Gérard Debreu called Theory of Value, which is perhaps one of the most influential books in economics, which basically lays out a very, very beautiful general equilibrium theory of the economy, which is one of the cornerstones of the discipline. So I think this is a very nice book. Another book that I always come back to, although is now many years old, is The Theory of Industrial Organization by Jean Tirole, which is just a beautifully written book with incredible insight, and I still learn from that a lot. Now, this summer, I've been spending time learning new tricks. I've been reading a book called The Book of Why by Judea Pearl. He is a computer scientist. I think that's the right way to characterize him. And he has been working for many, many years on causal inference and how can we say that something causes something else. And it's a wonderful non-technical book that, that also talks about machine learning. It talks about causal inference, of course. It also talks about Bayesian networks and a lot of other topics. So that I found incredibly interesting. And I can see that his ideas are everywhere right now, also beginning to be used within economics, but also within epidemiology, in fact, and other disciplines.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, something we ask every speaker we have on the podcast, what gives you hope?
Well, if you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, my answer might have been different. I've always been very optimistic in general and thought that kind of the arc of history was always towards progress, and I've become more skeptical over the last 10 years that we are necessarily always going in the right direction. On the whole, I think if we look at politics and the culture wars and international relations, I think there's a lot to be concerned about. I'm not looking for those spheres to look for hope. What I would say is that scientific progress is possibly the area where I find most encouraging. I think, for example, the development of the vaccine has been an extraordinary feat. I'm hoping that, I don't think that, of course, the science can substitute for good governance and civil society and politics, but technology is an area where I think there has been incredible progress that has improved our lives, and so so that's the short answer.
Well, thanks to technology, we're staying cautiously optimistic.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you tune in next time.